Okay. So, welcome back. And now we're actually going to start on dependent origination itself. Now we're going to get into the kind of more of what this retreat is all about. And let's see if I can get this to work a little better. Okay. The sutta I'm going to look at now is going to be like a summary sutta. I'm going to look at dependent arising origination as an overview to get an idea what it's all about, and then later on we can get into the details of this. So this is the overview. I should also say that you're probably aware already, but there is outside here there is some notepaper and pens and things. So if you have any questions about what I'm saying, please write it down, and we can do that in the Q&A session in the evening. I prefer not to have questions as we go through the suttas, because if we do, it often can be a bit distracting. Some people may have lots of questions, some may prefer just to sit quietly, so I think it's probably better to write it down. That's my personal preference anyway. Okay, so dependent origination from the Samyutta Nikaya. This is the very first sutta in the Nidana Samyutta. There's a whole section which every sutta, about 90 suttas or whatever, all deal with dependent arising or dependent origination. And this is the very first one. So it's like setting the scene, in a sense, setting down the overview of what this is about. Okay, so let's see what happens. So this is how it goes. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Sarvati, in Jeta's Grove, another Pindika's park. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, I will teach you dependent origination. Listen to that and attend closely. I will speak." "Yes, venerable sir," those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. I like the way he always starts off by saying, listen, right? Listen, attend closely, I will speak. So kind of get into this. This is important stuff. Don't mess around. Make sure that when I speak, you listen properly. It's kind of setting the stage for something profound. Everything in Buddhism is profound, but just kind of setting that stage to listen properly. Okay, so this is just the standard formulation of dependent arising, and I will just read through it, and then we'll afterwards we'll comment on these links one by one, in fairly superficially this time around, but again, just to have a basic background before we continue on. What occurs is dependent origination. With ignorance as condition, there are volitional formations. With volitional formations as condition, there is consciousness. With consciousness as condition, there is name and form. With name and form as condition, there are the six sense bases. With the six sense bases as condition, there is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. With feeling as condition, there is craving. With craving as condition, there is clinging. With clinging as condition, there is existence. With existence as condition, there is birth. With birth as condition, there is old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. All of these things come to be as a consequence of birth. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Kevalasa dukkha kandasa. This bhikkhus is called dependent origination. So I'm sure almost all of you have probably seen this formula before. It is a formula you see a lot in the suttas. And as always, you know that the teaching is important. If it is spoken on many occasions to many different people in many different circumstances, this is really the only kind of objective way of deciding whether something is important in the suttas or not. And dependent arising or dependent origination is one of those things that you see again and again in a vast number of contexts, in all the four Nikayas, etc., etc. So what is this all about? What is the kind of general purpose of this before we start looking at the individual factors? And to understand the overall purpose, it's useful to focus, first of all, on the first factor and the last factor of this whole sequence. Right? Because that kind of gives us, if you look at the first factor and last factor, you know what it's all heading to, and you know what its origin is. All the factors in between, they are like just transition phases, right? Going from one to the next one. I should maybe talk about that thing first of all. What is meant by conditionality here? It says ignorance is a condition for volitional formations. What does it mean that something is a condition for something else? What does that mean? And this is probably the first thing, because once you understand that, then you understand the process itself. And condition here means that if one thing is there, the next thing must happen as a consequence. It doesn't just mean condition in a kind of general sense, it means very specifically, if this is there, that happens as a consequence. And one way of describing this is to say that one thing is a sufficient condition for the thing which follows. If something is a sufficient condition for something which follows, it means the thing which follows has to happen when the next thing is there. Right? So what that means is that once you have ignorance, you have no choice. You have to have volitional formations. You know, you can want as much as you like, you can will as much as you like, you can scream and shout and jump up and down, but you are going to have volitional formations if you have ignorance. This is just par for the course. You can't avoid that. In the same way, once you have volitional formations, you have to have consciousness. This comes as a result of that. Then from that comes name and form, and all the way up, all the way to suffering. So this is what I meant when I said that the endpoints are important, because once the endpoints are given, all the intermediate steps are given as well. The whole conditional sequence is given once you have the first one, and then you look at the last one to see where it's all heading here. So this is one way of regarding conditionality. There's also another kind of conditionality, and that is the one which is important for the next paragraph, where we talk about the cessation of things. But I will wait, talk about that when I get there. That is called necessary conditionality. See, it was called sufficient conditionality. So it must happen, right? So now you start to see why this thing is so useful. Because what it means is that we are looking at the last factor. All of these things shows us the arising of suffering. Why there is suffering in the world. Why there are problems. This is what this dependent origination is all about. And of course, that's very useful, right? It's very useful to know how these things come into existence, because this is the thing that everybody wants to resolve. We want to get rid of suffering, rid of problems. We want to attain happiness, etc. So straight away, we think, yeah, this is great, right? Suffering, it explains to us why suffering comes into being in this world. In a sense, you get this feeling straight away that dependent arising, in a very, very real sense, shows you the solution to the, in a sense, the meaning of life. The meaning of life is to overcome problems, overcome suffering, finding a true contentment and happiness. Right? Most of us would probably agree with that. That's kind of our innermost yearning, is to find that. And here, you straight away, when you see the conditional relationship that leads to suffering, you have a feeling there is a solution here. There is a solution to the problem. Remember that when the Buddha, on his night of awakening, he's supposed to have reflected on this. This is one of the things that he thought about, dependent arising. He started off with old age and death, right? All the troubles. And then he asked himself, this is a problem. I have to overcome this. I can't just go around indulging in the world, doing all kinds of silly things when there is a problem to be solved. How can I enjoy the sensual pleasures in the world? How can I enjoy the family life when I know at the back of my mind it's all heading in the wrong direction? It's all heading to problems. It's all heading to a point where all those things that I have accumulated through a long life, they will be taken away from me. How can I go on accumulating attachments, accumulating possessions, when I know it's all going to end in tears? Right? It's going to go wrong eventually. So this is the Buddha, and so he thinks about that. Death is a real problem. And because of that, he asks himself, what is the cause of death? And that is when he uncovers this whole dependent arising and comes to see the sequence all the way back to its origin. And the origin then of this problem is a thing which is here called ignorance. Ignorance is avidya in Pali, and it doesn't really, ignorance is not a great, perhaps, as a translation, I suppose it's okay. It's very hard to come up with really perfect translations for these things, but remember that it's not just ignorance in the sense of not knowing something. It's a deep distortion in our perception, a distortion in the way we look at the world, in the way we understand things. So it's ignorance, it's delusion, it's a wrong view, it is not seeing things according to reality, right? It's all of those things. That is the problem. So it is this is the cause. Because we don't see things according to reality, we are trapped in suffering here. We are trapped in this endless cycle of birth and death, forever going back to the grave, piling up more bones from life to life, right? As it says in one of the suttas. This is the problem. So the cause is this avidya, which is kind of good news, right? Because if there is such a thing as delusion, and there is such a thing as ignorance, and there is seeing things in the wrong way, and the Buddha says there is a path to overcome that, then of course it's actually good news, because it means that there is a way we can get out of that ignorance. It's possible to see things in the right way. This is what the Buddha promises us. If it was impossible to see things in the right way, then, you know, there wouldn't be any point in sitting here meditating and doing all this stuff. We might as well go home straight away. there is, right? And this is the beautiful thing about this. So avidya is the root cause here, the root problem. This is in brief what this is about. Also, there's two maybe brief additional points that maybe I should mention at this stage that dependent arising is about. One of the reasons why suffering is explained in this way is because it shows you that suffering arises through causes. It is caused into condition by all of, caused into existence by all these conditions. What that means, there's no need for a self, there's no need for any I in there. This is a process. This has got nothing to do with each one of us, whether we exist or not, or whether there is a self or not. That's kind of completely irrelevant. This is a process that happens by itself. There's no need for any entity in there. So one way of seeing dependent arising, this is one of the things that I want to point out later on, that dependent arising is actually a way of teaching non-self. This very profound aspect of the Buddha's teaching. Very often you may have heard the Buddha often talks about the two views in the world. One view is the view of eternalism. When you die, you just keep on going on. You exist for eternity, in some kind of happy realm or whatever. That's eternalism. The self has to continue. Or the other extreme in Buddhism is annihilationism. When you die, you just disappear, right? Kind of a modern, kind of materialistic outlook on the world. But the Buddha says both of those are actually wrong. There is a middle way between those. And that middle way between those is precisely dependent arising. Neither eternalism nor annihilationism is correct from the Buddhist point of view. And the last thing that dependent arising shows us as well, and this is something I will show you when we look at these conditions in a second, it shows us how rebirth as well takes place according to this conditionality. The idea of rebirth, non-self, and dependent arising are all connected with each other. So very rich, right? Very rich idea, dependent arising here. It shows you how rebirth happens through cause and conditions, again, without any need for any self to keep the process going. And this is often one of the hardest things to understand in the Buddha's teaching. How can there be rebirth without some entity, some permanent thing that transmigrates from one existence to another one? You will talk to people and the first thing they will say, but that's impossible. There has to be something which goes across. Otherwise, it can't be. It's illogical. It doesn't make any sense. So even people who are, you know, extremely intelligent, they've got nothing to do with intelligence, these things, because it is delusion which is the problem. But it's very hard to see this. And this is one of the first things that people will often stop you and say, this can't possibly be right. But this is what dependent arising actually shows us. And for this reason, again, it's very useful. So let us look at these terms just one by one and see what all of this means. There's a bit cryptic way it sits there on the page. So ignorance, right? Again, delusion, distortion in view, not seeing things according to reality, wrong view, all of that is included in ignorance. So we are blinded, right? We are in darkness, as it says in the suttas. The Buddha is the eye of the world who sees things correctly, and then he imparts that understanding to us. So, because of that ignorance, it says here, volitional formation. Formations come to be here. Now, the first thing I want to say here is that volitional formations is one of those terms that you read and you kind of wonder what it means. I'm sure you know what I mean. I kind of know what it means because you, after a while, you think about it for a while, you sort of get a feeling for it. But I always felt kind of cold when I read this word, and it's not ordinary language. The Buddha would have used ordinary language to the people he taught, and volitional formation certainly is not an ordinary language. If you went to somebody on the street and asked them how their volitional formations are, they probably think you are a bit crazy. So what it means is basically it just means the will. It means the doer inside, the creative force inside, all these activities that we have, right? The mind starting things up, getting things moving. This is what this is. Sankhara is the Pali word. So it just means really activity. Activity of the mind, activity of the body, activity through speech. So when you have this delusion, you undertake all these activities. Why is that? Why do we do all these activities when we have delusion? The reason is because we think that there is happiness to be found out there. We think we know where that happiness is, right? Happiness is in relationships. Happiness is in enjoying all these sensual pleasures. Happiness is in acquiring power, amassing wealth. Oh, there's so much happiness to be had in the world, right? This is kind of the idea. And because we think we know where happiness is, we pursue that happiness. And this is an activity, the pursuit of happiness in the world, in sensual pleasures, in existence itself, all of that. So this is how delusion gives rise to activities. We do things. Now, when we do things, what happens is that depending on what we do, our consciousness will tend to be established at a certain level. And you can know this for yourself in your ordinary life, what that means. Because what it means is that you will have certain habits, you have certain ways of thinking, right? There are certain things you are attached to, there are certain pleasures that you tend to go for. So some people are very attached to sensual things and they will think about those things. They will crave for those things, they will indulge in those things. And you can feel it as if your mind is stuck on that level. That's what it feels like. Or if you have been meditating for a long time, you may really enjoy your meditation. You can't wait to sit down and meditate, right? And if you can't, and if that is the case, it means that your consciousness is kind of, that is where your consciousness is at. It's a bit higher kind of level. You are enjoying the consciousness instead. Your mind is always kind of looking forward to that, intending to meditate, enjoying that aspect of life. And in between, there's all kinds of variables, all kind of levels of consciousness. You can also do many bad things in life, and that can drag you down because you feel bad about yourself, right? You have this massive range of levels of consciousness. This is often called the stations of consciousness in the suttas. So these activities we do, they lead to a certain level in our consciousness. And then, because that level consciousness is at a certain level, this is just metaphorical, right, a level, then that means that when you pass away from this life, that level continues because you have established yourself in a level in this life. That level is there. When you die, it will continue there. So this is how when you are reborn, you get reborn in a certain realm, depending on that level of consciousness that you have. Right? You establish that level in this life, and then it continues on in the next life. So this is vijnana. This is the third factor of dependent arising. Now, when consciousness is established at a certain level in a particular realm, then the experiences you have in that realm will depend on where consciousness is established. So if you become an animal, you're going to experience the animal world, right? If you become a human being, you're going to experience human being world. If you become like a powerful deva or something like that, you're going to experience the deva world. If you become a Brahma, Brahma is like the equivalent to the jhana realms, you go into deep meditation, you will experience a world where you experience these jhanas more or less continuously. Yeah? And this is what is meant by consciousness conditions nama-rupa. Your experience, nama-rupa is about your experience. Your mental experience, your physical experience is dictated by where your consciousness has established itself. So in the human realm, normal experience in the human realm is within certain boundaries. So your experiences then, nama-rupa, is within those boundaries as well. Right? So you exist in a certain way, depending on that. Then, because we exist in this way, we have certain experiences. Part of that is the sense spaces, right? The senses that we have. We hear things, we see things. You smell things, all the senses give us this input all the time. It's the salayatana, the six sense spaces. Is that what it's called here? Yes, the six sense spaces, exactly. That's part of existence in any realm. At the very least, you will have one sense space, which is the mind. Very often you have all six. And because we have the senses, we contact the world. Contact means that we experience the world through the senses. That's really all it is. That's what contact is. If you shut off the senses, if you go into deep samadhi, you are no longer able to contact the world through those senses. You can't see anymore in deep samadhi. You cannot smell anything, right? Because that sense space has been cut off. But normally, we contact the world through the senses. And when you contact the world, one of the aspects of that contact is feeling. Whenever you experience something, there will be a feeling that is associated with that experience. And feelings, either it's negative, right? You don't like the feeling, and then you want to push it away, you have aversion towards it, you want to get rid of it. So you can see from feeling comes craving as well. Or the feeling is good. Wow, this is great, this is what I want to do. And that also gives rise to craving, because you want to pursue that feeling in the future. So feeling is one of the crucial aspects in dependent arising. It's one of the pivot points because feeling is probably the most important thing in our experience that drives us to do things, drives us to move or whatever way, because it is so immediately important to us. We want to have good feelings. We don't want to have the bad ones. So it drives the craving. And then when we crave, that means that craving is all the desires we have, all the moving forward in life, right? Very much of our life is based on desire and craving. Always moving forward, always heading towards something else, heading in a new direction, desiring something. Every desire, however small, is always about the future in one way or another. And because we crave things, what we do is that we start to accept, look at the world, or start to take up things in the world. We grasp onto things in the world. Right? This is what upadana is about. The next one after tanha leads to upadana. It is here called clinging. Again, I'm not sure if clinging is the best of translation, because clinging means holding tightly onto things and not wanting to let go. That's usually what clinging means. But what this refers to is that we take on board all these things, all these ways of living. We take on board views, right? We look at the world in a certain way. We take on board a particular way of living. We live in the house, so we can have the sense pleasures around us in the house or whatever. And we take up all these things. We take up an education, a profession, and all of these things are part of this craving. And we act in a way so we can satisfy our cravings in the future. That's what upadana is about. And once we have taken on board all these things, we have all these things we own, we have all these views, right, that we consider our own, then our existence, bhava, we exist in a certain way depending on that. Right? And you can see that in your own life. It's very easy to see that we exist in a certain way. You know, you tend to crave for certain things, right? It tends to be the same things that we think about, that we reflect on, that we are important to us in life. There are certain people that are important to us. There are certain ideas that are important to us. There are certain objects of in the world that we are more attached to than others. And this is our existence. This is what is meant by existence here. Our mind is stuck in a certain way. We exist in a particular way here. And when we exist in that way, we are creating karma in accordance with that existence. Our consciousness, again, is at a certain level depending on that existence. This is just where I was before. I was talking about consciousness being at a particular level. This is what you're seeing here as well. Consciousness is at that level depending on how you exist. Your habits happen to be in a certain way. And then, when you die and you are reborn, the next link here is birth, jati. Again, you are reborn in accordance with where your mind is at. How you have existed in this life, that is how you are reborn. There's a continuation there in your consciousness, in your state of mind. And of course, once you're born, that's it, right? You have no choice. You have to get old, you have to die, you have to be departed, you have to, you know, all the things that you are loved, beloved to you, that they have to go eventually. And this is the problem of this human existence of ours. Then you are in trouble. You've had it. Once you get born, that's it. You are finito. And you will and you will eventually have to reap the consequences of that. So this is how this whole mass of suffering comes to be, originates in the world. And this is, in brief, the idea of dependent origination. So I hope that makes a little bit of sense to you. I'm going to go through these things in quite a bit more detail over the next few days, but hopefully that is kind of a starting point anyway, so you have a little bit of background as we do this. Now, then we have the reverse of dependent origination, which is often called dependent cessation, right? If all of these things can arise, they can also cease. So the whole sequence, and let me read it out. I might as well read it out again, because it's even though it is pretty much the same, it's probably useful just to reinforce what is going on here. So this is how it goes. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of volitional formations. With the cessation of these activities, there is the cessation of consciousness. With the cessation of consciousness, there is the cessation of name and form, of experience, if you like. With the cessation of experience, there is a cessation of the six senses. With the cessation of the six senses, you have no experience of the world. There's no contact anymore. With the cessation of contact, there is a cessation of feeling. With the cessation of feeling, there is a cessation of craving. With the cessation of craving, there is a cessation of grasping onto things. With the cessation of grasping onto things, there is the cessation of existence, of karmic active existence. And with the cessation of existence, there is the cessation of birth. And with the cessation of birth, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair, they all cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering here. Right, so here we have the reverse, and of course this is the good news, right? The first part we had looked at before, that's the bad news. It ends in old age, death and suffering. This one here ends in the ending of all these problems. It ends in happiness. So in Buddhism, there actually is such a thing as a happy ending, which is great. So in the end, if you do the right thing, a happy ending can be expected. You can really ride off into the sunset, right? Most movies, you ride off into the sunset and you just encounter more suffering as you ride off into the sunset. It looks very nice. It's not really riding off into the sunset at all. This is the real riding off into the sunset. It actually is good. It actually ends well here. So what is going on here? And I was saying that the conditionality here is slightly different from the previous one. I was saying before that one aspect of the conditionality that we see in dependent arising is one of sufficiency, where one factor must lead to the other one. But here we're seeing the other aspect of the conditionality in dependent arising, which is the aspect of necessity. And necessity means that If the condition isn't there, the subsequent, the result cannot happen. In other words, that thing, ignorance, must be there. If ignorance isn't there, there is no way that volitional formations can happen. It is necessary. One condition is necessary for the result, right? So quite a simple idea. You have to have the previous one for the subsequent one to happen. So if the previous one isn't there, it means the next one ceases. This is exactly what it says here. With the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance. In other words, if you practice the Noble Eightfold Path, which is what the Noble Eightfold Path is all about, it's all about giving up ignorance and wrong views and delusion. If you actually do that, and that ceases, then volitional formations no longer have any legs to stand on. Volitional formations just disappear, right? They have to cease as a consequence. And as a consequence of that, each factor along the way here ceases all the way up to suffering, because each one is a necessary condition for the subsequent one, until you get to the ending of old age and death and all suffering because of that. So what is going on here? So very briefly, what is happening is that once you see the world in accordance with reality, you no longer have the delusion that there is all this happiness out there, which you have to go and get, right? You no longer believe that I should kind of, you know, oh, there's so much happiness in the world to kind of pursue. That kind of, that ignorance, that delusion starts to fade away here. And you start doing all these things. You stop trying to create happiness where no happiness can be found. I will look at this much more later on. So because of that, once you see that, you stop acting for those things. Because you stop acting for those things, your consciousness is no longer stationed anywhere. The station of consciousness depends on the volitional formations. You have to actually, when you do things in a certain way, then that is, your consciousness is then established according to those activities. But if you stop doing things, if you stop projecting that consciousness into the future, then actually consciousness is no longer established anywhere, because there's no projecting of that consciousness into the future anymore. Desire is what projects you into the future. Desire is about the future. Once desire has been abandoned, that doesn't happen anymore. So consciousness disappears in the sense that it's not stationed anywhere. And because it isn't stationed anywhere, it means that when you die, it doesn't have anywhere to go, right? There's nowhere for it to continue. It is not stationed anywhere. And because there's nowhere for that consciousness to be established in the future, it means that nama-rupa, experience, there is no experience to be had. Consciousness has to be established somewhere for experience to continue. So experience stops. Nama-rupa is gone. When there's no experience, of course, you have no senses. When you have no senses, you're not contacting the world anymore. When you're not contacting the world, there's no feeling. When there's no feeling, there's nothing to crave for. There's nothing to crave for. There's nothing to be taken up, because there is no craving to be satisfied. You don't exist in a particular way, no existence. And because there is no existence, you aren't, again, consciousness isn't established anywhere. There is no birth as a consequence. And because of that, event, the whole thing just comes to an end because of that. That is very quick, but I will explain these things in more detail as we go along, so you get more understanding of what's happening here. But the main point here is just simply that the cause of suffering, the cause of the problem, is this thing called avidya, this lack of understanding, lack of seeing things, lack of seeing the world in the right way. That is great to know that, because it means we have a possibility of overcoming that and heading in the right direction. Okay, very often when you read the Four Noble Truths, you read that it is craving which is the cause of suffering. And of course, that is an important thing to understand and to take into account. But it's not really sufficient to be able to do all that much. Because yes, craving is the cause of suffering. But you can only do so much about craving. It's very hard to, you cannot actually eliminate craving in your life unless you go deeper into the matter. And this is where dependent arising is so useful, because it shows you the root cause of the problem, why craving arises in the first place. And then you can actually do something about this. Okay. Excuse me. Okay, so then the sutta ends with that, and it says, this is what the Blessed One said. Elated, those monks delighted in the Blessed One's statement. Okay, so there you are, dependent arising in brief. And now what I want to do is to look at these factors one by one and analyze them and look at them a bit more in more detail. So, first of all, let's start off with ignorance. So this is the next sutta in the Nidana Samyutta. It is called the Analysis of Dependent Origination, Vibhanga. And it analyzes each of the terms. And I have kind of divided them all up so that each one, we can look at each one in sequence. So the Buddha says, and what, bhikkhus, is ignorance? Not knowing suffering, not knowing the origin of suffering, not knowing the cessation of suffering, not knowing the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called ignorance, or this is called delusion. Right, so I'm sure you straight away you can recognize this. This, of course, is the Four Noble Truths, right? So it means not knowing, not understanding the Four Noble Truths is really the cause of all this. This is what that ignorance or the delusion is all about, not seeing things in accordance with reality. So, of course, to really know and understand the Four Noble Truths, according to Buddhist teaching, you have to be an Arya, you have to be a noble one, you have to have direct insight into the teachings. But we can at least, we can approach this subject. We can get some idea about the Four Noble Truths, even though even though you're not an Arya, you can still have some idea what is going on. And of course, any approximation to the truth is much better than having no idea about these things at all. So it is a little bit hard to know sometimes what to make of these Four Noble Truths and how to relate to them. So I want to go into a little bit detail and show how they actually work in this particular case. And very important to understand the connection between ignorance and the conditions that follow afterwards, independent arising here. So the standard exposition of the Four Noble Truths in the suttas is found in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is traditionally said to be the first discourse of the Buddha. Perhaps it really was the first discourse of the Buddha. And this is the next sutta I want to have a look at. And it's a very interesting sutta, a very profound sutta. And for that reason, I think it's always good to contemplate this one a little bit as well. So this is how this sutta goes. So this is this famous sutta where Venerable Kondanya, who was one of the first disciples of the Buddha, he became a stream enter when he heard this sutta, according to the tradition. So it had this ability to open up the eyes to someone, to the truth of the Buddha's teachings. So you can see here that this sutta is addressed to the bhikkhus of the group of five, and the Venerable Kondanya, he was one of those five bhikkhus. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at the Bada Nasi, this is Benares, in the deer park at Isipatana. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus of the group of five thus. So this is the deer park. I'm sure some of you have been to India and you have been to the deer park. It's one of the very nice places to go on pilgrimage to the deer park in Varanasi. It's quite, the atmosphere there is actually quite nice when you go there. Isipatana, Isi is like rishi, right? Rishis are these sages. You find them, the rishi is the Sanskrit word. So it means like a sage or a seer or something like that. And patana means fall, and there is some story behind this, the fall of the seers, what that actually means, but it's really quite irrelevant, so I won't even get into that, and to be honest, I'm not entirely sure of the story anyway. So this is where this is happening, the deer park at the Isipatana in Benares. And this is what the Buddha taught there. Because these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What to? The pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble and beneficial. And the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble and unbeneficial. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, and to Nibbana. So here the Buddha starts off with talking about the middle way. And of course that is essential, because remember that prior to this, the Buddha, or not the Buddha, but the Buddha-to-be at that stage, he has been practicing all these ascetic practices. And these five monks were with him. They were also ascetics, right? And they were really pursuing these ascetic practices to the absolute maximum. And it says in the sutta that the Buddha took it to the point, or the Buddha-to-be, he took it to the point where it couldn't be taken any further. And if he had taken it further, he would have died, because it was, he was basically completely wrecked by these ascetic practices. And of course, because of that, he has to start off. He has to tell these five ascetics, well, listen, this is wrong. This is the wrong way. It doesn't work. They left the Buddha when the Buddha decided that the ascetic practices were wrong. They left him because they thought he was backsliding, right? He is returning to luxury, it says in the sutta. It's terrible, you know, you've been practicing these incredibly ascetic practices, you're so thin as a rake. It says that if you touch your stomach skin, you can feel the backbone. If you touch the backbone, you can feel the stomach skin. You can imagine how thin you are, completely, utterly thin. And he decides to eat a little bit, and straight away the group of five says, ah, he's returning to luxury, right? You're having a bit of rice or something. So that is kind of, this is why this... this goes. So you're supposed to, this was kind of the ancient Indian way, really to kind of mortify yourself, torture yourself to the maximum, lie on a bed of nails, right? These days you only see these things in the cartoons, right? Lying in the bed of nails. In those days it actually happened. They really did that. They really did lie on beds of nails. And there weren't even that many nails on that bed. So the fewer nails there are, the worse it is, right? If you lie on the bed of nails. So this is what is happening here, and it's very strange. It seems to be something very deep-rooted in human psychology, that if you mortify the flesh, you mortify the body, because this is where all those sensual desires are in the body. So somehow you have to overcome those. And of course, the way to overcome them, the way we normally think about things, we have to do the opposite. We have to torture ourselves a little bit. In that way, you overcome those the badness of the body, which stops you from freeing the soul, right? Classically the soul, or in this case the mind, to reach a higher level of greater kind of happiness. And this is so common, not just in Hinduism, but in Christianity. You find this almost everywhere in the world, the same idea. You find it also, I think, to some extent in Buddhism as well, where people are willing to go through all kinds of pains to kind of go through, to find some higher understanding as a consequence. But really, as far as I'm concerned, the right way to find that higher happiness is through wisdom, and to use the middle way rather than forcing yourself to do all these kind of painful things. So this middle way idea is actually very important, it's very profound, and it's something that I would recommend you to keep in mind in your ordinary practice. It's actually quite hard to find that middle way, because we tend to either indulge and then we go to the other extreme and we torture ourselves. It's actually quite difficult to find that middle way, because it feels a bit like a vacuum, right? If you're torturing yourself, it feels like you're doing something important. Yeah, I'm doing something. It feels, right? There's a feeling there. And whenever there's a feeling, we feel alive. It kind of, it, sustains our sense of self. Yes, I exist. I feel something here. Or you indulge. Again, you feel like you exist because you're indulging in one way. But when you're kind of in the middle there, there's almost nothing. It's almost as if you're disappearing. Your sense of self is disappearing. And of course, that's part of the point, right? Your sense of self actually is becoming more diminished. That's good. It's actually happy when you think about it, when you feel it for yourself. You start to see it's a positive feeling when that sense of self starts to disappear. But for most people, it's also a little bit scary. And that's why it is often considered preferable to have pain rather than to have nothing at all. So the Buddha really needs to drive home this point, right? Middle way. Listen, middle way. This is the way. This is where the body really disappears, because the body becomes irrelevant. The body is only relevant if there is pain, because then there's something to be sorted out. The body is relevant if there is a happiness or pleasure to be had through the body, because then, of course, it's important as well. But when you take away both these extremes, the body becomes irrelevant. And that's where meditation really can happen. That's where the Noble Eightfold Path, that's where Samadhi, that's where Satipatthana, all of these things can happen, because the focus on the mind comes to prominence when the body fades away. So this is the Buddha's middle way. So you don't pursue the sensual pleasures, right? Why not? Because, and he gives you all these adjectives here, why you shouldn't do that. Because they are low. Hina quite literally means low, or it means inferior. That is important to keep that in mind, right? Of course, it is very hard to understand that sometimes, to understand why sensual pleasures may be called inferior. There is, of course, a vast range of sensual pleasures. Some are very coarse, some are very refined, some are somewhere in between. It's very hard for a person who is always used to sensual pleasures to actually understand why they would be called low. Why is that? And the reason is very simple. You know, remember that we are here talking from the point of a view of a Buddha. We're not talking about the point of a view of ordinary people. And for the Buddha, who has access to deep states of samadhi, who has access to a higher viewpoint, it's like he's standing on a mountain peak and he's looking down. And from that mountain peak, those sensual pleasures do look low. Why? Because you have found something much better, something much higher instead. So this is really the point. The point here is not to denigrate sensual pleasures or to kind of be, you know, to kind of feel bad about them or anything like that. It's just to understand that there are different levels here. There is something higher. There is something more beautiful. There is something more profound. There is something far more happy than ordinary sensual pleasures. And you can think about it a little bit like, you know, if you go to a nice restaurant somewhere, you eat some very nice food created by this master chef, right? I'm not sure how good these master chefs are, but a really good chef, right? And then if you eat some very nice food, very beautifully prepared, you're not going to think about the Big Mac down the road, right? Big Mac is irrelevant. It's completely, you're not going to have any craving for that Big Mac. Or if you have got a nice new car, I don't know what, you know, BMW, whatever, you're not going to crave for that, you know, second-hand 20-year-old rust heap, you know, which is available. You can be really proud of your new BMW. So whenever you have something which is higher, you're not interested in the lower things. You don't even think about them. In exactly the same way, the Buddha has risen to a higher level. He's got something which is far, far superior. Of course, he's going to regard those inferior sensual pleasures as irrelevant, as precisely inferior or low, right? So this is how we go. And sometimes, you know, life is like this. We start off in life when you're a student. You're really happy to have any old car, right? A beat-up old car is great, because otherwise you have to walk or you have to take a bicycle or whatever. But then as life progresses, you kind of go up in the world. And ideally, we want to go up in the world in this sense rather than just go up in the world in terms of getting better cars or better houses or whatever. So remember this, we have to understand the perspective here. We're coming from the perspective of the Buddha. The point is not to denigrate sensuality and feel bad about it. Of course not. The point is just to understand there is something higher. The purpose is to lift us up and to, you know, look for something which is more greater than what we have already. and then you're seeing it in the right perspective. So this is what is going on here. And this is also very important with the next translation here. It is translated, the translation here is vulgar, which I think is a very unfortunate translation because it gives completely the wrong idea of what is going on. The reason why Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as vulgar is because the traditional meaning of vulgar is, it means ordinary people, right? It's of the ordinary person. That's what vulgar traditionally means. But in the present day, vulgar means like something which is kind of coarse, right? Unrefined. It's really something, you look down upon things. If you say somebody is a vulgar, it's like you're looking down upon that person in a sense. But that is not what is meant here. It's not about looking down upon anything. The Pali word is gammo. Gammo means of the village. In other words, common, ordinary stuff, right? So it's low, it's ordinary, it's common. That is what is meant here. So important to get these things right, otherwise we get the wrong idea. So it's common, the way of the worldling, portu janiko, portu janika, putu, many, jana, people. So it's the way of the ordinary person, the way of the many folk, the many, many beings. So again, it means ordinary, common, same kind of idea. It is ignoble, right? It is anarya. It is the way of those people who have not seen the higher happinesses that are available. Once you start moving into the realm of samadhi and jhana, and certainly when you start to move into the realm of seeing these things, the Aryan realm, then of course that is when you have the noble vision and you understand why this is inferior. Ignoble, it is unbeneficial. It doesn't lead to anything, right? It just leads to more of the same. This is kind of one of the frightening things about craving and desiring things. It just goes on forever. There is no end to this. You crave, and that craving then, because it doesn't really get satisfied, it doesn't really fulfill, craving arises again. And so on, it just keeps on going and going and going. As long as you pursue the cravings without trying to get to something higher, it's always going to perpetuate itself. It's always just going to continue. There's no end to it. It's kind of scary, isn't it? There's no end to this. It just goes on and on and on forever and ever. And unless you do some effort, unless you start to look at the world in a different way, you're always going to have this leash around your neck, being pulled around by craving. You are a slave to craving, as it says in the suttas. Ajahn Brahm mentioned this at the monastery in a talk recently. He said that there's no end to craving. And it really struck me when I heard that. Wow, this is so powerful. There's no end. If there is no end, it means it's this kind of scary. There's no getting out of it. All you are doing is perpetuating, doing the same thing again and again and again. Year after year, decade after decade, life after life, eon after eon. Universe after universe, right? Keep on running around, trying, thinking that you're finding a solution. But actually, all you're doing is being trapped by this force, which never is going to give up as long as you pursue it. So this is the problem here. So it is unbeneficial, doesn't go anywhere, doesn't bring any real happiness. So that is the one extreme. And then you have the other extreme, which is the pursuit, it says here, of self-mortification, the Atta Kilamatanu Yoga. And you could maybe translate that as self-torment or self-torture. Might be more kind of a common way of putting it. And that is no good because it's painful, right? That's exactly what it's about. It's about inducing pain. It is ignoble. It's not the middle way. It's not the way of the Aryas. And it is unbeneficial. There's no benefit to be had from these things. There's no purpose in sitting there on the floor for hours after hours thinking that you're getting somewhere in your meditation when all you're doing is experiencing pain. What you're doing there is just torturing yourself, kind of the modern way of torture, the Buddhist way of torture, sitting in the same position for hours and hours and experiencing pain. So please don't do that, because chances are you won't get anywhere at all. It's unbeneficial. It says right here, black on white, the Buddha's word, right? What is the Pali unbeneficial? Anatta Sanghito. connected with that which doesn't go towards the goal. Okay, without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, dasana, gives rise to knowledge, and jnana, which leads to peace, to pasama, to direct knowledge, or to, as I said before, to insight. I think insight is a much better translation there. It's abhinya, to awakening, and to nibbana, to extinguishment itself. That is the middle way. And of course, that middle way is, next paragraph, what is that middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to all of these things? It is this Noble Eightfold Path, that is right view, right intention, or right aim, if you like, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. This because is that middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to vision, gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to insight, to awakening, and to extinguishment. The Noble Eightfold Path is that middle way, whereby you're not indulging, you're not torturing yourself. That is where the Noble Eightfold Path becomes possible. Without that, it is not possible. Last year, on the Sam retreat last year, we talked about the Noble Eightfold Path for 9 days. And if you are interested in going into that in more detail, you can maybe, you can perhaps listen to those recordings if you wish. But that is what it is all about. So right view, right? You start off with seeing things in the right way, looking at the world in the right way, at least a little bit, right? You start at least to understand that being a moral and good person is good. It's beneficial for yourself and beneficial for others to live a moral and upright right life. That's the very least. And then from that comes the right intention, the right aim. You get the right purpose in life. You start to act in the right way, to live in a good way. So you start to speak gently and kindly to others. You don't lie. You are honest in your speech. You act in the right way, right action. You get a livelihood that is wholesome, right? Most wholesome livelihood is to be a monk or a nun, be a bhikkhu bhikkhuni. That's the really highest of right livelihood, if you live that life well. Then you get the right effort. The right effort is the overcoming of the negative aspects of the mind, overcoming the ill will, the desires, and all of those problematic aspects of the mind. That's what right effort, the main aspect of right effort. And from that, you can start to meditate. This is when right mindfulness comes, right? Right mindfulness can be summarized in just watching the breath. And by watching the breath, you overcome the remainder of the hindrances. And when you overcome the remainder of the hindrances through watching the breath, you achieve eventually right stillness, samma samadhi. And when you have right stillness, you are ripe, you are ready. The fruit is ready to drop, and you can achieve awakening at any time when right samadhi is there. The one famous simile that Ajahn Chah is supposed to have told is the idea that all you have to do is to sit under the mango tree and wait for the fruit to drop, right? When you get to samma samadhi, the fruit is ready to drop at any time. All you have to do is to wait for awakening to come to you. You don't have to seek awakening. You don't have to go anywhere. It is your mind is ready. And that is why the Noble Eightfold Path ends with right stillness, because then you are ready and ripe for the results. Okay, so that is the middle way for you. And we haven't really started with the Four Noble Truths, but we will have a look at those, I suppose, tomorrow morning here. Okay, so that is all for now. And so please just continue enjoying yourself, and I will see you again this evening at 7:30, I think it is, with a guided meditation and with some Q&A after that. Please remember that there are note paper and things out there if you want to write down a question or anything here. Okay, so that's it for now.